The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 105 of The Morning After. Episode 105 of The Morning After. I am Jesse Kiefer. And Sari Kamen.
I'm Sari Kamen.
How are you doing this week, Sari?
I'm great. Thank you.
I know you're in the throes of working on your thesis project.
Yes, the never-ending thesis.
And so what happened this week?
Things are slowing down a little bit in terms of like the interviewing part. But, today I'm actually going to visit Natasha Pogrebinski, who we've had on this show. She's the chef at the restaurant Bear in Queens. And she has an amazing story about being born in the Ukraine, I believe, what is now Russia. So I'm really excited to go and talk to her after the show today.
And she has this insane story that she told on the show.
I think the episode is, it's
like,
called
like 90 Natasha. Something. Or Bear. No, it's called Bear.
It's called Bear. Yeah.
The episode's called Bear, and she tells the story about
her she's escaping. Actually been getting a lot of press. She was just had a feature in Sever this past week. So I'm excited to get some more press for her, hopefully, and get her locked down before she's too famous.
Are you going to have some vodka? She has like a 3-vodka appetizer.
I mean, only if
like she
offers it.
It's like just served with bread. It's on the appetizer menu, and it's like 3-vodka flight and bread.
That's hilarious.
I love that.
Like amuse-bouche.
Amuse-bouche vodka.
Yeah.
Please. So we have a pretty packed show today, which is exciting. We are not sticking within our comfort zone of New York City. We're actually going to be traveling to the south of the United States with Maggie White, editor-in-chief of The Local Palette. She is going to talk to us about Southern cuisine and as far as that extends in the Southern United States. And then we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with a family winery that has been making wine for 500 years in Croatia. And Croatian wine is super hot right now in New York, and it's spreading throughout the U.S. And so we're going to talk to them about their winemaking philosophy, the grapes, the food, everything Croatia, and wishing that we were there. So without further ado, I'd love to introduce Maggie White, editor-in-chief of The Local Palette, Food and Culture of the South.
Yeah, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
And you came all the way from South Carolina just to see us.
I did.
That was so nice of you.
Well, it was nice of you to have me, so thank you so much.
Well, that is really our pleasure. And she brought us cookies and magazines. She's, you know.
I mean, seriously, like, cookies or wine is, you know.
Yeah.
Friends
for life.
You guys are set.
Friends for life, yeah.
Exactly.
You're a permanent guest. Welcome anytime.
Thanks.
So these magazines look delicious. There's, you know, they actually remind me a bit of, a little bit like of Sever. I mean, or, you know, any of like the really well-known food magazines that have these gorgeous photographs right on the cover. You know, I don't think I'd know by looking at them necessarily that they're Southern. One has a picture of...
It's scallop carbonara.
Yeah.
It's actually a version
of a delicious pasta with a scallop on it, which I wouldn't necessarily think of a Southern, and another one looks like, you know, some side of like...
It's a fish stew.
Chia pino or something like that.
Chia pino.
Yeah.
I love it. Chia pino.
Whatever.
No, I was also noticing the way you said scallop. So I say scallop, and you used to say scallop. Is that, because I know you're originally from New England, correct?
Yeah, I don't know what that is. I don't know if that's a Southern or just a me thing.
Just a you thing. Well, I know Sari and I are super interested in food magazines like this. And, you know, how did you get from your life in New England down to writing about food in the South?
Oh, well, you know, it's a convoluted path probably, as most people have, but I moved to the South, to Charleston, South Carolina in 2007, from the Boston area. Was so excited about it, and I've loved the South in every capacity. The obvious way is the weather and the pace, but just the way people embrace life there is just really inspiring and wonderful. And Basically, I ended up moving. My husband and I moved to France for a year on a fellowship I had. And
France? We had an episode about that.
And when we came back, I had always been a writer. I'd always been, you know, interested in food, as many people are. And this magazine had just come out. And I went to the launch party for the local palette in Charleston in October 2011 and started working there about a month later. Right. So
what's the mission of the local palette? It says food culture of the South. But what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, sure. That our mission really is just to celebrate all things culinary in the South, in our region. And, you know, I think some people sometimes confuse it with restaurant reviews or things like that. And certainly we do celebrate restaurants and restaurant personalities because those are a big part of the culinary culture of the South. But it's also about celebrating everything that's happening in the culinary sense, agriculture, people who are doing great responsible farming, whether it's hogs or pastured poultry, people who are just that make up the fabric of what makes it all so dynamic. And that can be, you know, the person who's been making sweet potato pie for, you know, generations in a dive, you know, in the middle of nowhere, to somebody like Sean Brock, who has these world-renowned restaurants and is doing wonderful things to promote our culture. So our mission is really just to celebrate and to educate and to just evolve, and as the culinary community evolves in the South.
Cool. I mean, you are from New England.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of people, when they talk about the South, it's very much attached to nostalgia and, like, you know, memories they have growing up in the South, because there's so many specific foods that, you know, when you think of the South, you think biscuits or, you know,
traditional
peach pie. Yeah. And that kind of like tradition, and people are very loyal to that. So that must be a really interesting I don't want to say the word like burden or anything, but it just must be a really interesting perspective from you to be like writing about this kind of food, but not having experienced it or lived it, you know, your entire life. So what does your like outside perspective bring to someone who's supposed to be an authority on this type of cuisine?
Yeah. I mean, it's a humbling position to be in, and I'm grateful that I'm in the position and that I've been accepted in this role, because I'm not from the South and by no means an expert. But I think to some degree, maybe my outside perspective brings a real appreciation for maybe what I don't know. And I'm not quick to assume that I know everything. And I am so inspired by the traditions of the South. And I don't find it to be a burden to think of the things that people, when they think of Southern cuisine, they want, you know, there's always people who kind of want things to stay the same and to like have their same Sunday meal and things like that. But I've really found with our audience and our demographic ranges from people in their 20s to people in 70s, they've been really excited about what we're doing and promoting what's happening right now in the region. And I think that there's a combination and a wonderful balance of tradition and evolution happening there.
Is that ever a struggle? I mean, I guess, you know, you have, there's like so much responsibility in your position to kind of like honor those food ways and those traditions, but, you know, you're in the media. So there's also something about, you know, moving forward and playing with traditions and creating change and inspiring other food people or food like-minded people such as yourself to try new things and embrace other cultures outside of themselves. Do you ever feel any sort of backlash, or do you ever have to like think outside yourself and make sure that you're doing enough?
Right. It's a good question. I don't think of it like a struggle. And I think part of that is just because we have such a wonderful team and some people on the magazine staff and certainly our contributors in the photography and illustration and writing capacities are many of them are from the South. So, you know, we all work together to produce this product. And, you know, while I might have the name, the editor in chief, it's a very much of a collaborative effort all the time. And I think because we have all these different people working to produce this magazine, we have the ability to maintain a balance. But for sure, I mean, when we go through our editorial calendar and we're thinking about, you know, this piece looks really traditional. Let's, you know, for example, I'll just bring up our November issue where we had a city focus on Savannah. So we had some things going on in Savannah and we featured this really traditional Savannah Thanksgiving, which was great, you know, and it was just, but it was very traditional. And then we had this other piece on fermenting and someone making kimchi at home and just sauerkraut and that kind of thing. And that was a little out there. But, you know, I feel like with the two of them in there, they're created a great balance. And people who may have thought they were only excited about one found that they are excited about both. So,
yeah. So with your perspective, with your very global perspective, having lived in Europe and on the East Coast, how would you describe Southern food if you had to kind of like give us the elevator pitch or just sort of what is Southern food to you?
It's a labor of love and passion. I don't, living in the South and being so entrenched in my world down there now, maybe it's happening everywhere, but it just seems that in the South, people care so much about food now. And I find it just to be a really inspiring, great place to be at this moment in time. And not just, not just from the restaurant perspective, which our restaurants are terrific, across the board down there. But also just people opening their eyes to agricultural opportunities we have and different people leaving, sort of professional jobs, I use that in quotations, to go and make cheese or make beer and whether or not they do it full time or part time, it seems like everybody's got their finger into something and I think it's just a great thing. So.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was going to ask, technically, according to the local palate, how far does the South stretch?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, everybody might have a little bit of a different perspective on that.
Because being in the South, people argue about that.
They do. Yes. And I mean, there's people who say, Florida, parts of Florida aren't part of the South and parts of Texas aren't. How we define it at the local palate is basically D.C. all the way south to all of Florida and then as far west as Texas. So, there's some areas in there that people might say are gray, but that's okay.
Kansas
is not part of our demographic.
It's the Midwest. Yeah. All right. And then all of Texas. That's a lot.
I know.
Texas.
I struggle a little bit with Texas because Texas. Some of it is so southwestern. And we're the Southeast.
I grew up in the Southwest, and so to me, I think of Texas as being the Southwest. Yeah, I do. I don't know. With just a thick accent, that's kind of.
Texas is kind of itself, So I guess it can kind of go either way. But to be honest, there's so much exciting thing happening in the cities of Texas that maybe we kind of want to pull it in.
And it's not fair to cut it in half.
Right. It's not fair to cut it in half.
But if only we could.
So favorite Southern state, come on.
Oh, wow. Well, I live in Charleston, South Carolina. It's a dream to live there in every way. But I've just been inspired by everywhere. I was recently in Memphis and I just think that city has such soul and such kind of grit. And that kind of thing is attractive to me. But also New Orleans, I don't know how anybody couldn't have a wonderful time there and find something fun and fascinating. Nashville certainly is really exciting. Mm-hmm. But every Southern city I go to, there's something there, and honestly, our April issue, which is on the stands right now, is a city spotlight on Charlotte. And my preconceived notions of Charlotte were that it was just sort of steakhouses and really kind of not going to be that dynamic. And I was so pleasantly surprised by the dining scene there and how it's evolving and how people are embracing it. And there's always something to learn and, your expectations are always blown to smithereens, it seems.
Would you say that Charlotte or what city would you say is really the most up and coming right now? Most exciting things happening?
Yeah. Jesse, I think Charlotte might be one of them, really. I mean, because for so long it had this reputation as being, sort of, like I said, steakhouses and whatnot. And I think they have the infrastructure there to support a great culinary movement. They've got industry, they've got farmland, they've got, certainly they're a hub for people coming in and out. And I think that they're on the rise. I think they're really doing some cool things. But that said, I think every city's doing some great things. I know I'm too much of a positive person. I shouldn't be in New York.
No, you should be doing exactly what you're doing.
Bring that Boston back.
But are you guys at the Palate? Are you more reporting on what's going on, or do you feel like you're raising the bar as a magazine, or inspiring restaurants or other food leaders to kind of step up their game?
I hope so. I mean, to go back to the word, the balance and what we struggle with, what we hope to do is clearly to entertain and to educate. And I think there has to be a little bit of a balance in there. I mean, for me, I'm so passionate about responsible farming, for example, but that's not something that everybody can relate to or that everybody should have jammed down their throat. And this isn't necessarily the platform for it, but it is the platform to introduce those kinds of questions in the magazine. And I think it's nice to be able to offer a product where it might make people think a little bit more about what they're doing, because food does touch all aspects of our lives. So I think we're raising the bar in that sense. Rather than just being sort of, I don't want to say a fluff piece, but we're not, you know, it's not just recipes and having fun. And it's also like, let's be cognizant of where we're going on a culinary path as a community and as a region, and let's ask the right questions and be smart about what we're doing.
Can we talk about vegetables for a second?
Of course. I'd love to talk about vegetables.
Okay, yes.
Okay, thanks, Jesse. So we've had this thing going on in New York, like this kale thing.
Yeah, okay.
Where, you know, it kind of like came out. I mean, it had always been there, yeah, but it like came out.
Right.
And then, you know, it's like it's having a long moment. I mean, I love kale. I'm not like a kale hater, but, you know, there's something to like putting kale on every single menu and
totally.
Every single
it's like
recipe.
The Miley Cyrus of vegetables.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. And you can – it's like
less
kale.
Slutty, though.
Right. Yeah, I should
martini.
Apologize to kale. That was
a kale martini.
Yes,
shut up.
I swear to God, I heard of it. I swore I saw a kale martini, and it was slutty. So you can drink it. It's a smoothie. It's a salad. It's everything. It's everything.
It's everything.
Are you guys experiencing this?
Yes, we are. We are having a kale moment. It's not just specific to you all here, but. I think it's kind of interesting because, you know, kale on its own, I'm a vegetable lover. I love vegetables. It is bitter and it's tough, you know, and trying to make it at home is, you take some work. So I've found that it's forced, you know, a lot of chefs who, and a lot of cooks too, who may not have, like, it pushes them to think like a little bit more creatively. And I've been really impressed with some of the kale dishes I've had, you know, and I certainly can't replicate them at home. So, but yes, we're having a kale moment.
Are there any other vegetables you feel like are, you know, maybe not the same status as kale? I know Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, I was just going to say Brussels sprouts. Okay. And I love Brussels sprouts. So I'm like really pleased with it. But, and I'm happy because I felt like they really needed a revamp. You know, their like image that people had stuck in their head about Brussels sprouts was not,
everyone
was not
tells
great.
That story. Like,
but yes.
Everyone hated Brussels sprouts.
I used to hate Brussels sprouts.
But now I love
now
them.
I hate Brussels sprouts. Yeah. And now I put them in my chopped liver.
Yeah, that definitely, those two are, it's not just specific to New York. Yeah.
So to kind of piggyback on talking about vegetables, most overrated Southern food in your opinion?
You know, I think all the things that might be overrated, when they're done well, there's a reason why they had that reputation. You know, like fried chicken, for example, there is nothing like a amazing piece of fried chicken. But then there's so much bad fried chicken out there. Same thing with shrimp and grits, you know, and we had talked a little bit about this prior to the show. You know, what sort of are the dishes that people capitalize on, and they come down just to get shrimp and grits, and people will just kind of phone it in on the menu. If you have great shrimp and grits, that is so great, and it's unlike anything else. But I cringe when people tell me the places they went to get shrimp and grits, and, you know, just thinking about the awful slop that they're eating, you know, it's disheartening. But there are wonderful places to get it, too. I think you just have to inform yourself a little bit.
What's your favorite dish? What's your favorite Southern dish?
Gosh, I like everything.
Yes. This is part two of the same question.
Okay.
And is this something that has changed since you've moved? Mm-hmm. What's your favorite dish, or has your favorite dish changed since you've moved to the South?
Right. Well, yes, because I would say one of my favorite things in the world to eat is okra. And I didn't eat okra prior to living in the South because we didn't have it in the Northeast, or I didn't have it at my house. So I love okra. I like it fried. I like it roasted. I like it pickled. I like it every way.
She's the bubblegump of okra.
Totally. I'll take okra any time of the day. So that, and yes, things have changed. I think, you know, pickles also. I am a pickle fiend. And I think that there was a movement a couple of years ago where everybody was pickling, and people still are. But, you know, it just.
It's like, called Brooklyn.
Yeah.
It's called the Brooklyn brand. We can pickle that. Sorry.
So, but yes, I think my tastes have changed just because I've been exposed to so much more. And I'm fortunate in my position that I get to eat so much great food. So my tolerance for bad food has become pretty bad, which might sound snobby, but I think it's important for everybody to eat good food. And I'm not just talking about expensive food. I'm talking about just good food.
Cool. That is awesome.
Yeah, do your research.
Yeah.
Totally
yeah.
makes sense.
Eat good food. We support that.
And I imagine the local palate is a fantastic way.
It is. Kind of I hope that people who are listening today will subscribe. I think we do.
Do you think people should?
Terrific.
People who don't live in the South, it could still
absolutely.
Be.
In fact, my friends who I'm visiting and staying with in New York, they have it piled on their kitchen. And I know she didn't plant it there because I moved it aside and like there were other stuff. So like it would have been tough to plant them on her counter. But no, I think it's a relevant magazine for anyone who's interested in food. And interested in just a culinary community, and it's certainly not specific to the South. So I hope that people enjoy it, and it just grows and grows.
Yeah, I mean, I am salivating over this.
Like you're in a trance. You're in a trance.
I'm staring at this shrimp.
So while Sari trances out over there, what's the website for
thelocalpalette.com? So.
Super
please,
easy.
Yeah, visit there. You can subscribe there. We're actually in the process of redoing our website, so it's only going to become more dynamic in the coming months, which is going to be really exciting. And you can get it on newsstands as well, at Barnes & Noble, King Cullen, Duane Reade. But definitely check out the website. It'd be great. thelocalpalette.com.
Is it distributed throughout the states?
It's distributed nationally. So,
great.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. So you should be able to find it. Like I said, up here it would be Duane Reade and King Cullen and certainly Barnes & Noble, mm-hmm. Whole Foods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, that.
Oh, yeah, we've heard of that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Heard of that. Well, Maggie Waite, thank you so much for coming on The Morning After and coming off, you know, all the way up here. I'm glad the weather behaved for you.
Oh, it's terrific. Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a break here on The Morning After, and we are going to come back with the Miloš family from Croatia, winemakers over 500 years. This is The Morning After.
Today's music is by Iggy Dean on heritageradionetwork.org.
Oh,
Today's program was brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run digital and offset print house that brings together eco-friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Using environmentally responsible papers, non-toxic inks, and wind power, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and mindful sustainability. Rolling Press offers advice on reducing paper waste and energy consumption, helping you save money and minimize your carbon footprint. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
And we're back here on The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sarah Kamen.
We just did a whole studio switch up. Whole new crew, whole new cast.
You guys should have seen it.
Maggie's still here from the local palette.
Hey, Maggie.
And
hi.
But now in studio, as the most people I've ever met from Croatia. It's only three of them, but still solid group of people. Franica, Ivan, and Josip Milos. From Croatia, they are winemakers, and I would love to just immediately reach out to one of them to kind of paint a picture of specifically where you are from in Croatia.
Okay, so
the Sofranica, obviously.
Yes, hello everyone, and thank you so much for having us here. Our very good friend and our partner in the States, Stetson from Blue Danube Wine Company, is also here with us. He is our host in New York.
Not Croatian,
but
honorary
Croatian. Yeah, we come from the peninsula of Pelješac, which is the southernmost part of Croatia, very close to Dubrovnik, and we live on the peninsula in which we are also growing grapes and making wines, and that is basically our main purpose why we are visiting the States. We are introducing, through the Blue Danube, our wines to the U.S. market.
So when you say peninsula, that to me, well, that actually, the definition is surrounded by water.
Yes.
Correct.
We are surrounded by Adriatic Sea, Mediterranean Sea.
So tell me, I guess, with that sea influence, what kind of wine you make?
Well, we grow, my family actually lives in the same village called Ponikve at the very beginning of the Peninsula of Stone for, as we know, the last 500 years. And our tradition of making the wine is that long. In the old part of the village, we have a wine cellar that is 500 years old. And in all that time, we were focused only on one grape variety, which name is Plavac Mali, which actually means like a little blue one, because the color of the grape is, it has a very clear and nice blue color. And then the clusters are a little bit smaller. The vineyards are very close to the Adriatic Sea. We are very open to the sea. We get the nice breeze from it, and we get that nice sea freshness minerals in the wine. So Adriatic really has enormous influence on the vineyards. And another thing is that the soil that was built on the Pelješac Peninsula throughout the centuries is a sandy soil, limestone, which gives that special minerality and taste to the wines. That's the one aspect of terroir which we are trying to present to the market.
Now, Plavac.
Yes.
Plavac Mali is also a grape that we know here in the States.
Yes, you.
Which is called Zinfandel.
Yes. Zinfandel's origin is from Croatia. In Croatia, we call it Crnjenak Kaštelanski, and it is one of the, let's say, parents of Plavac Mali. So they are connected, but they are not the same grape.
Not the exact same grape.
Yes.
Okay, so this might... I'm a little less educated in this arena than Jesse is, but... So
Croatia is, it's, you know, hands off for me, too. I'm still totally learning.
Croatia's not my wheel. How does that relate to the Primitivo?
Primitivo is, with Zinfandel, it's part of the same family.
So they're all...
In a close connection, yeah, okay. Yes.
Don't know anything about wine. Sari worked in an Italian restaurant.
I guess I do a little.
So I guess I'll move on to Yvonne to ask about the philosophy of winemaking for you and the way you approach the Plavac Mali.
Yeah. So actually, when I was coming here, I was a little bit afraid to talk in English because my English isn't perfect and I have accent. It's like strong one, like Croatian one. And actually, this is the fun thing, because it wouldn't be nice if we all talk the same, you know. So, and the good thing about our wines, because our wines, let's say, speaks all the languages, but they have a strong Croatian accent. And then, so it's like it's a real Croatian wine. When you taste it, you feel it that it's wine from the unique area, from that steep vineyards on the slopes of the hills on Pelješac Peninsula. It's organic vineyards, and the whole process of making the wines is really natural. So it's all the wild fermentation process. All the wines are aged in big oak barrels of Croatian oak.
An old oak.
Yeah, old oak, which is like, I don't know, some of the oldest barrels are even from the 40s. We have some also new ones, but it's all like 2,000 liters big oak barrels, which is quite unique. It's all Croatian Slavonian oak, which is really popular in the whole region, not just in Croatia and Italy, all around the places. And then after the aging in the barrels, which takes like 2 and 3 years, something like even more, we age our wines in bottle for more than 2 years, like 3 years, something like that. So it's quite long period of aging to keep the wine, let's say, to let the wine rounded, to keep it drinkable, but to keep the pure taste of it. So in our wines, we want to, I would say it really simple. We want to for people to taste the grape variety, Plavac Mali, and to taste terroir, Pelješac Peninsula. Not against not new oak or things like that, you know, not fancy things in the wine. So that's like the main philosophy, just simple set. And then there's much of things behind it. So
absolutely. So when I think peninsula, when I think surrounded by water, I don't necessarily think red wine is all that you call, because that's all that you grow is,
yeah,
is
so actually
this grape.
We have just
you only make red wine and rosé.
Yeah, just so we have just one grape variety, one vineyard, one micro location, and we grow just one variety from which we make a big selection of wines, which is really interesting. We make our rosé, which is quite unique wine because it's made from the old, like 35 years old vineyards. So because of that, it's quite unique rosé wine. It's not like average rosé just for sipping. It's more like a rosé you will combine with some food and things like that. And then we have a whole selection of red wines, of course, because it's a red grape variety. So like Plavac, which is 09 vintage, and then some old wines from the old vineyards, which is we named them Stagnum, like our premium brand. For example, now fresh release, it's Stagnum from the vintage 2006, and we have also some older wines.
Oh, wow.
And then we have also dessert wine made on the typical way how we do dessert wine in South Croatia, with driving the grapes,
indoor
space. Yeah, so big selection of the wines from just one grape variety.
So Stetson, I got this great blog from you about eating oysters with Plavac, which to me doesn't make sense. You know, you are not doesn't make sense because I've never had it. But I would assume that I would want to pair that kind of like briny saltiness with Muscadet, something bright and fresh, or a Syrtika, whatever, something specifically white wine based. So tell me about your experiment, because you had heard about this being something that that is done in Croatia.
The blog was shucking Plavac, and so it's, I think while absolutely counterintuitive and unfamiliar to oyster fans in the U.S., around their village in Stone, you actually have oyster beds. And so this is not, even I think in Pelješac, it's not the most common combination, But the wines, it's the simple statement, what grows together goes together. Mm-hmm. And I think that that can, in the case of Plavots from Pelješac, that can even transcend something as standard as Muscadet and oysters. And it has to do with the effect that the proximity of the vineyards to the sea leaves on the wines. The wines actually have a certain salinity or brininess. Mm-hmm.
Which is called friskina, right?
No. No. This is a big art. We don't really...
I saw that. I read that. I
so
was
well,
like, oh,
this
I
is a word.
I was going to have that great year, word yeah. for that.
I believe you, Jesse.
Thank you, sorry.
This was a word that largely I and Blue Danube, we've introduced the word because it's unusual to encounter a wine that actually tastes like the sea. The French, in southern France, you have the word garrigue, and it describes the Mediterranean environment, the flora and fauna, the rocks and the stone. What you have in Dalmatia relates to that, but is absolutely Dalmatian. And for myself, also an outsider, you know, this is one of those things that make Dalmatian wines completely individual and unique. And in terms of pairing the oysters with the wine, just try it.
You can get oysters for a dollar. You'd actually have to go to Croatia to experience?
No. My parents live in Maine.
The answer is yes.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So we're going to have to figure that out.
Well, if you drink the wines, you will be compelled to visit the area.
Compelled. Yes.
So I have another question about just Croatian wine in general. Maybe I'll bring this back to Fornica. So we in New York feel like it's, I mean, at least for me, I feel like as a wine buyer, I started seeing it maybe 4 years ago when Stetson brought his project over to New York from California. But why haven't we seen wines from Central Europe like this? Because we know Italy, we know France, we know all these places, and Croatia is very close to this.
Yes, maybe Stetson could give you a better answer on this. I will just say from our perspective, mm-hmm. we have met Frank, who is the owner of the company, 10 years ago, mm-hmm. and we were always talking about our wines, about exporting them to the States. And I think with them, did it slowly, but in a huge faith and hope that we will do better and better every day and every year. And mm-hmm. not just in terms of selling wine, in the terms of educating people and bringing them through the wine, our culture as well. Mm-hmm. And the place where we live and how we live and what we eat and the personalities of the people who make those wines. So I think it will take us maybe a little bit longer time, but for all of us, not just as a producers, as for people who present the wine here to the States, as well as for you who are looking now maybe in last 4 or 5 years a little bit more for Croatian wines, but also from wines from the region, mm-hmm. To get the real knowledge what that region is and how that region has a huge tradition in making wines, because we were doing it for 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. So maybe if you have the perspective, has two faces. We are new country with the oldest tradition mm-hmm. of winemaking. So we now have to rebring it to the market again. And
so that's in anything to add to it?
Well, in a sense, I think it relates actually to what Maggie, what you were saying earlier, like, you have like grits and shrimp are something that's very typical, and you could have lots of mediocre examples of it. If you have something great, then it leaves a big impact. I think similarly, you have to have the right person looking for something special. They have to have the awareness of that, and those products have to actually get to the United States. So it's a slow process, and I don't think that Croatian wines per se are the next big thing. I think it's more that this is important terroir. These are wines with great tradition that are totally unique, and there's only a small audience for things like this because they're not made for the market. They're very individual, and it's good that the market stays small because there's not so much of it.
We wouldn't have.
Yeah, it's quite limited. But politics, you know, the communist or socialist period had a big influence on the traditions of winemaking in these regions. And every time I meet with the producers, I learn new stories about these places too. And one that was new to me was that Franica and their grandfather was one of the first to plant on the slopes where it was difficult to farm because he was interested in quality, not quantity. You'd get paid the same amount regardless of where you grew it and how little fruit your plants produced. So their oldest vines were actually planted by their grandfather, and the site was it's a virgin site. Nothing had ever been planted there previously, so no other crops been grown, nothing was ever sprayed, and they continue, you know. He didn't do this for commercial reasons. He did it because he was following something, and this continues to drive what you guys do.
Yeah, but slowly products like that also find their market. It just needs maybe a little bit more effort and a longer time. Mm-hmm. But time, especially very important ingredients in wine like this.
Is there an organic certification in Croatia?
Yes. Croatia is now part of the European Union.
Oh, okay.
But before that, we also had our own organic certification, which is now adopted through the EU.
Is that something you've
as
pursued?
Well. We as a winery have it.
You do?
Yes.
I have a question about pairing, because I know a lot of people in the East Coast are kind of afraid of, like, when you say the word Zinfandel, I happen to love it, but I think a lot of people have the perception that, you know, when it's not really made well, it's totally blown out, it can be sweet, it can be just like a juice bomb that sort of overpowers anything you would want to eat with. How would you explain your wines so that it becomes a little bit more accessible in the way that you could pair it with food?
Those wines are all the different types, and this big spectrum Ivan was telling you earlier are all made of the same grape variety, in which we have been working the last 30 years to see how that grape variety behaves in different circumstances, and still how to keep the essence of Plavac Mali in rosé, in dry wine, in dessert wine. So it all depends on which wine we are talking about. But the wines, as we see them, are elegant, classical, balanced. They are high in alcohol. They have good acidity. They have good tannins. They have good dry extracts. They are made to live long. Mm-hmm. And they are made to behave. Maybe you will find them differently every day. Depends on you, too, how you feel that day and what you have with the wine.
What are some ideal foods or dishes to pair them with, other than oysters?
In our region, like our traditional food, oysters, because we grow Ostrea edulis, it's a European type of the oyster that is grown only in this region. In our tradition is also to have a goat cheese, a sheep cheese, sack cheese. We also use a lot of lamb meat, goat meat. We eat a lot of fish. So we eat a lot of wild pigs. That's like a coastal Mediterranean cuisine, and it can all go well with all of those food.
Hmm. So I have one last question. You're a family. You've got to work together. Maybe I'll put this to Josip. How is it working with your family on a day-to-day basis? You know, I'm sure you don't always agree.
Well, sometimes we don't agree, but it's a part of that.
How do you manage the family stress? Do you have to have timeouts?
But it depends. Each of one is different our own way.
Sure. So yeah. You just drink a lot, right?
Sometimes.
I don't know, Ivan, Fredica.
So actually, there is a lot of families. I have friends who also have a brother and sister. But I said to them, it's a totally different thing. You met them maybe once in a week. I live with these guys. I work with them. We need to deal with problems together. And then we get really good together. So it's really fun. We travel together. So we are a whole month here in the States, promoting the vines, driving around. So Actually, we had, just in California, we had more than 3,000 miles on our rental car, all over the places, to Vegas, to Phoenix. So it was really fun, and we get really together, and we are happy when we manage to do something successful. So,
I haven't seen them argue once. I mean, I've been with, we've spent most of the time that you've been in New York, we've been together. We've had some late nights, some wild experiences, and I didn't think about it till just now, but no conflict, or it was very private.
I think we will have it in Croatia, because for them, this is the first time in the States. This is my third time here, and we are very, but never with the wines. So for us, it's very excited to see how people react on mm-hmm. our wines. Mm-hmm. So I don't think now we have time to deal with anything else. But probably when we get home and when we have when we start our routine, then the things will change.
Well, I mean, I have one thing to say about specifically Miloš Plavac Mali. Yeah. I'm still working on that pronunciation.
That's
one day,
beautiful.
One day I'll get it. The first time I tried it, it was a very intense experience, because I feel as though the palate and the tannin and probably that salinity, that sea air, leaves this like tingling element, and not in a sparkling way, but almost like almost in like a numbing way, like you eat a piece of tarragon in it, and these like herbal notes kind of.
Has like
hit
a
your mouth,
effect.
Very cooling effect, and it was just a very, very cool mouth feel, and unlike Zinfandel from California, and unlike Primitivo, it had just like this amazing finish and texture, and really experience, whole body experience that, I will say is unlike anything else. So, good job, guys.
Thank you.
I'd like to know where I can get some
of this wine. The finest shops and restaurants in New York and California, primarily. Terroir Tribeca, or Terroir in general, has been quite supportive of a lot of the, not just Miloš, but many of the brands that we represent. But I think Miloš has found sort of a special spot. I was trying to track down some bottles of 08, and it was clear that it was all gone. But you can't find the wines in a lot of places. We did a tasting at 56 Degrees, which is in Brooklyn. Melissa Hernandez, who runs the program, has one of the largest selections of wines from these regions in the area, which is, usually the wines are like salt and pepper to have a Croatian wine or a Slovenian wine. There are only a few places you can go and try a number of these things. Mm-hmm. Terroir is a good one.
Stores in New York?
Well, I think I actually would recommend. Bin 50 or 56 Degrees in Brooklyn is one store in Brooklyn. Discovery Wines has a number of our wines. In Vino, which is actually a little Italian restaurant, we're going to do a class there tomorrow. Keith Beavers is the two things that he loves: Star Wars and wine equally. And is maybe the only person on earth trying to combine these things. We won't be doing it tomorrow. We'll really just be focusing on Miloš Plavac. But
good idea.
I mean, I would also say Roberta's has been.
That's probably pretty. Yes, considering that we're sitting here, and Amanda knew us from California, and she has done. You know, Roberta's is a place where you can kind of be fearless with what you do in terms of food and wine, and what you sit. Most people think Bordeaux is a grape. So I think to have a Croatian wine is, we as professionals almost tend to overcomplicate it. To the consumer, they're like, oh, it's delicious. It's Croatian. It goes with the food. I remember it. So it's just wine.
Yeah. Well, I encourage everyone to check out some Croatian wine if they can find it. Sari?
Jesse.
It's been a fantastic show.
It really has.
Really enjoyed it.
I've really enjoyed everybody.
Josip, Stetson, Yvonne, Franica, and Maggie. Thank you all so much for being on this episode of The Morning After.
The South Beats Croatia.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.